So where did we end on the nucleus and nucleic acids?
Oh, perfect. Okay, I don't need to do this one. I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember if we finished this one or not. Perfect. Okay. Did I just close the wrong one? I guess I shut down the wrong one. All right. So we've talked pretty extensively that protein synthesis is actually very important because, as we all now know, everything is proteins. Uh-oh. Please don't tell me I lost. Oh, there it is. I hate the thought of losing my clicker. Okay. We've talked about how, as I said, everything's all quite about protein synthesis. And so where do proteins get made, or how do proteins get made? And that's kind of what this is all about. So we have a couple things to review. So we can see here, we've already talked a little bit about this. You know, we've got the nuclear envelope, which we said has very large pores in it. We also now know that DNA molecules are extremely large enough that they can't leave the nuclear envelope. They're just too large a molecule. So we have to have some way to take a copy of the gene, in other words, the protein we wish to make, and then that copy is a small enough molecule that it can leave the nuclear envelope via the nuclear pores, where then there can be some interaction with the ribosomes, which either are A, sitting on the endoplasmic reticulum, or B, free-floating, and it is the interaction between the RNA molecule and the ribosome that we create polypeptide bonds, meaning the bonds between amino acids, which then go to the Golgi complex to get folded to create a viable protein. That's kind of what we're learning today, okay? So, protein synthesis is the process by which a diverse number of proteins is created. As stated previously, it is the type of proteins that determine the physical and chemical characteristics of cells, of course, therefore, then the organism. When a gene's DNA is used to create the template for the protein, this is known as a gene expression, because it's a gene that contains a recipe to make whatever protein that's being asked for. So protein synthesis then has two parts to it. It has a transcription and a translation. Now, if we think of old movies and courts, what's that person called that's clicking away in court? It's a transcriber. What are they doing? They're recording, or they're making a copy of whatever is being said in the court. The same thing here. We are making a copy of the gene. Okay, so transcription is the information encoded in a specific region of DNA that is transcribed or copied to create a specific type of RNA. Okay, so it's describing it's going to create a specific type of RNA. And to jump a wee bit ahead, it is that created RNA that leaves the nucleus via the nuclear pore to meet up with a ribosome to create the protein. Translation is we take that RNA, that piece of RNA that is the copy of the gene, and is when that RNA attaches to a ribosome, the ribosome basically reads the RNA and translates it into the appropriate sequence of amino acids to form the protein that was asked for in the first place. Simply, does that make sense to you? So we've got the joy of cooking in the nucleus. Something comes along and copies the recipe for chocolate cake. It takes the recipe out of the nucleus and goes over to a ribosome, which then translates the copy to make the chocolate cake outside the nucleus. Now, I used to use a bit of a different analogy, and I'm not sure if it fits anymore because of the age group. Does anybody here remember a cassette tape? Okay. So what I always talk about, well, I'm never quite sure, because I've seen those videos where they give cassette tapes to kids on video, and they go, what is this thing? Anyways, you got a tape in there, right? Right. It's like a VCR tape, too, right, for movies. So the tape runs across what? What does the tape? Good. It runs across a head, and what's the head do? It reads the tape, and therefore you get or music out the speakers. Okay. So the RNA that gets created that is the copy, because the cassette you can put an album on and click record on the cassette, and it records whatever you want on the album, for example, right? So that RNA is that. It's recorded or transcribed the gene that's asking for the gene expression or the appropriate protein. The tape then leaves, the RNA said tape, leaves the nucleus, and the ribosome is like the head on the VCR player or the cassette player. It reads the RNA and through a process asks for and gets the appropriate amino acids to put together to create eventually the appropriate protein. Okay? So, transcription. So, we say that the DNA has genes. The genes ask for specific proteins. So, transcription occurs in the occurs in the nucleus. And as I said, that's because the DNA molecule is far too large to leave it. And frankly, we don't want DNA to leave the nucleus anyways, because it can get banged around, which can result in mutations and all sorts of bad things. So we want to keep it nice and safe and snugly inside that nuclear envelope. In the nucleus, really I should have nucleolus there, all three types of RNA are made in the nucleolus. Do you remember what the three types are? rRNA, which is ribosomal RNA, tRNA, which is transfer RNA, and mRNA, which is messenger RNA. Good. Okay. So, the DNA, as I said, is too large a molecule to exit through the pores. The gene sequence must be copied into a smaller package in order to leave the nucleus. Because remember, again, think of DNA as the spaghetti in the bowl. You might have a spaghetti strand that's this long, and from a microscopic perspective, only this much of that strand of spaghetti could be a gene that's asking for a particular protein to be made, right? Well, we can't cut that off the DNA and take it outside, because that would screw up the whole genetic code. So again, we split the DNA molecule to copy the exposed small part of the gene, and that's why it gives us a smaller molecule to leave the gene, leave the nucleus via the pores. A sequence of base triplets represents the genetic information. So do you remember what a sequence of base triplets is? Right. Correct. Okay. So what are they? What am I doing? I'm so used to whiteboards. I hate blackboards. I'm so sorry. Shoot. Oh, well, I'm going to get shit for that one. Okay, so we've got T. What else have we got? A, G, and C. G and C. I see if I can get another color here. And what do we have? C, right? Okay, so being as the DNA molecule, what will this be corresponding? Correct? Whoops. Yep. And G. Okay. Well, we're just doing DNA at the moment. Okay, so we've got these bound, right? They're the rungs on the DNA molecule. Three of them, a little too far, is considered to be, again, a sequence of base triplets is a codon. Okay, now these three equals a specific amino acid. Okay, so that's asking for it. So that's a DNA molecule. The process of transcription then is copying this to take outside the nucleus to make the protein, because again, it's too large a molecule to get out. So the first thing we need to do is we have hydrogen that is binding
both sides of the ladder together, right? Now, here's one thing you need to understand. Because of the way these bases line up, you know, T to A and G to C, they are, in fact, actually a copy of each other, just mirroring, correct? So whether you chose these three, or whether you chose these three, it would be the same protein, wouldn't it? Do you understand that? It's just they're a mirror image of each other in the DNA. So it's double-sided, but because of those base pair, those triplets or those bases pairing in that particular pattern, either side represents the appropriate protein or amino acids to grab. It doesn't matter which side you take, okay? Because they are mirroring each other. So RNA polymerase unwinds the DNA and exposes one side of the DNA for transcription. So we have to remember that it is DNA, when it's chromatin, yes, it's like spaghetti, but it is twisted just a little bit, right? It kind of twirls just ever so slightly in that long strand. So first we have to straighten it out, and then we have to have an enzyme that then therefore splits the hydrogen bonds, thus exposing one side or the other. So if I were to do it this way, oops, so I'm going to take a strand of DNA here. Actually, I'm going to do it this way. I'll do it this way. Okay, we have one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, and 10. Okay, so using that code over there, what should be here? Yellow, good. What should be with green? Good. What should be with red? Good. What should be with yellow? Yellow, red. What should be with white? Good. What should be with green? Good. What should be with yellow? What should be with yellow? Red. Good. What should be with red? Yellow. Red. And so forth. So, what happens in regular DNA molecule, the polymerase untwists the DNA and splits the hydrogen bonds. Okay? By doing so, it exposes both sides of the DNA molecule. Everybody see that? Okay, so I'm not going to put polymerase in here because you're going to see a really cool video very shortly. But just understand that the polymerase has split the DNA molecule, thus the hydrogen bonds, and therefore we expose both sides of the DNA. What are we exposing? Right. But also we are exposing, oh, we'll just do one more here. Red and yellow. Right. So it's exposing the codons. Okay, and the codon is asking for what? Good, amino acids. Okay, therefore, in this state with the hydrogen bonds when they're in there, you can't read that DNA, right? It's bound together. So the polymerase splits the two sides apart and comes along and reads one side or the other. Okay, everybody follow me? Okay, so as it travels along, it's splitting the DNA, and behind it, the DNA is closing back together with hydrogen bonds. So at the point where the polymerase is, it's like a cassette head. As it's rolling through the DNA, as every single triplet it has, right, it copies it and creates out of its backside the RNA copy of the strand of DNA that it's reading. Yes, no, maybe?
kind of, sort of. When you see the video, I think it'll make more sense. The only thing that's different is because we are making RNA, there's one change, correct? So everywhere there is a what, an A, RNA will make a U rather than a T. Correct, okay? So the RNA will always have a U as compared to the T, right? So that's the RNA. So, yes. Yes. Yeah. Is the mirror image of the other. Correct. Yes. Correct. Okay. So, yes, good. I think this is the first one. Can we just lower the lights here just a bit for me, Ken, please? Thank you. Isn't that the switch right there? Oh, they're down here. Sorry. Friggin' place. Okay. Just give me a second here. So, that said, the newly created nucleotide sequence specifies the amino acid sequence to create the new protein. So, you saw how long that yellow strand was that was leaving at the top of the polymerase. I mean, when we teach it in class, we keep it quite small, right? Just a few codons here and there just to get the sense of it. But you can see that fundamentally, it's a fairly long molecule of messenger RNA that gets created. So the newly created nucleotide sequence specifies the amino acid sequence to create the new protein. Translation is the reading of the messenger RNA by the ribosome. So we say translation is carried out by ribosomes. Now we have to remember when we think back to ribosomes, there were two subunits to a ribosome, right? So there are two subunits. The small one is for binding with the mRNA, and the larger one is for binding with tRNA. It has three binding sites, a P site, an A site, and an E site. Now it could be incorrect, but I think someone told me last semester in Tortora, he does use a different letter for one of the sites, correct? And it doesn't really matter because I don't ask questions on the names of the sites per se. I just want you to understand what they do, right? So the small one reads the messenger RNA, and the large subunit is where the binding of the amino acids is done, okay? So the P site is where the peptide bonds are created. So when we take two amino acids and bind them together, that is known as a peptide bond, okay? So where two amino acids are bound together is a peptide bond. So this occurs in the P site. The A site is where the next amino acid is to be bonded, and the E site is where the empty tRNA leaves. So we now have some new stuff here to think about. We have the messenger RNA, which is carrying the message, which is the copy of the DNA molecule that it unzipped and made a copy of. The transfer RNA, we haven't talked a whole lot about it, but its responsibility is to transfer the appropriate amino acid over to the ribosome to get attached to the next one and the next one and the next one, okay? So you have mRNA, which is the copy of the DNA. Then you have the tRNA, which is what's bringing along the amino acid when it's being asked for. And remember, every tree equals an amino acid. So basically, the small subunit reads, it's called the codon, and it's like, tyrosine, we need some tyrosine. So transfer RNA, which is carrying a tyrosine amino acid, it comes on over. And what do you think's on the bottom of that tRNA? The matching bases to the codon that's being read by the ribosome. And that is known as the anticodon. Okay? So that would mean that if the ribosome was reading this codon, which is, we say it was, I don't remember here, yellow is C, U, and C,
What would be the anticodon? CUC would be GT. U, it replaces T, so it would be CAC. Right? Okay? So that means that this transfer RNA on its part of itself would be the anticodon, in other words, the match to the codon that the ribosome's reading. And so it comes along, and because it's got the anticodon, it just so happens to be carrying tyrosine with it. Right? And then it goes into the big unit, sits in there, waits in the entrance site, and then when it's time to bond, just like a conveyor belt, everybody moves down one step, and wacko, we get a peptide bond. While that shifted, the next codon came into the next spot, and we need an anticodon of transfer RNA that brings the next amino acid in. And when it lands and comes in, everybody goes one spot, bam, we get a peptide bond, and we're starting to create a string of peptide-bonded amino acids. See, I told you not to write. Just listen, and we'll come back to it again. Right? Kind of hard to write and listen at the same time. So, let's do this first. Number one, messenger RNA binds to the smaller subunit at the mRNA binding site at the start codon. So every first codon of every transcribed gene is AUG, every time. AUG is called the turn-on codon. I just made that up. The turn-on codon. Sounds like a funky soul song or something, right? So it is the AUG that turns on the ribosomes that are involved in creating the peptide bonds and therefore the protein. Okay, so AUG is the start codon. It doesn't code for a particular protein necessarily, but it starts the process. So AUG is known as the initiator transfer RNA. The transfer RNA anticodon, of course, which would be UAC, attaches to the mRNA AUG by pairing the complementary bases. AUG represents the amino acid methionine, and this amino acid always begins the growing strand of peptide bonds. So AUG is always methionine every single time, every single protein that this makes. You must have AUG to enter into the ribosomal complex in order to start the peptide bonding to create the protein. Oh, my God. Okay? Is this making sense to everybody? Not feeling it. All right. Now, we're going to talk it through, as I said, and we'll come back to it again. The large ribosomal subunit attaches to the smaller one. Now, when the large attaches to the smaller one, we now have a completely viable ribosome to create peptide bonds and therefore a protein. Okay? So, the large ribosomal unit attaches to the smaller one, which now creates a functional ribosome. The initiator tRNA fits into the P site as the first one. So here we go. Here's our transfer RNA here on the bottom. We can see that it is into the small subunit here in yellow. And when the initiator piece, the AUG, gets into here, it attracts the large subunit to attach to the small subunit. So when the strand is red, okay, our first amino acid is methionine that comes with UAC, which is the anticodon to the initiator AUG. Do you get that? Yeah, you need AUG to start the whole thing. And AUG always brings methionine. Correct. In the transfer RNA, because it's the complement or the anticodon to the codon that was just read. AUG was the first codon that was read, correct? It's the initiator. So when the small subunit reads the AUG, it attracts the large subunit, and it grabs onto the very first amino acid that comes with AUG and its anticodon UAC on the transfer RNA, and we start the process. We'll get there. Okay. Now the next one gets read. UUC.
Because that is a codon, correct? So the transfer RNA that has the anticodon, in this case UUC would be AAG, that AAG brings one of the 20 amino acids. And over it comes, and it lands into the spot, right? And we get a peptide bond between the methionine, which was the initiator amino acid, to whatever the next amino acid is. Now, everything shifts down one, okay? The UUU, which is the anticodon to the AAA, brings lysine in this case, okay? Because it shifted down, we get a peptide bond. Now, this anticodon transfer RNA, AAG, it's empty. So it buggers off and leaves the site open. And then the next one gets read, and the next transfer RNA comes in. Don't worry, we'll go over again. Okay? The anticodon of another tRNA with its attached amino acid pairs with the second mRNA codon at the A site. The large subunit catalyzes the formation of the peptide bond between methionine, which is the very first one, the initiator, and the amino acid at the A site. The resulting two peptide proteins become attached to the tRNA at the A site. Now, what we can see here, here's your AUG, okay, with this UAC, which is methionine. The next one is UUU. In this case, this is phenylalanine. So what happens is, this is the bonding site. Remember, A is the entrance site. P is the peptide bonding site. And E is the exit. Okay? So the transfer RNA with the anticodon UAC, it's come in to the A site with methionine and has traveled down one space to the P site, which therefore exposes the A site, which is the next codon UUU, which attracts the anticodon transfer RNA, which is AAA, and along with that one, it brings phenylalanine. Yes? Because it was exposed and it's been read. UUU is AAA, which is phenylalanine. Okay? Now, it's going to travel down one. So the AAA transfer RNA enters into the P site, and the P site is where we get the bond between the two amino acids. The empty initiator, UAC, no longer has an amino acid attached to it, so it buggers off. It's empty. It's not needed anymore. And when everything shifted down one, you can see that the A site is exposed, correct? There's nothing in there. Well, we have ACG, which means we need a transfer RNA that has the anticodon, UGC. That brings another amino acid, I think it's thorinine, if I remember what it's called, and it will come into that A site because that A site's been read to say, hey, we need a tRNA with UGC. And it slips into the A site, and everybody shifts down one. And now the UGC is going to go into the binding site where then THR binds to PHE, and everybody shifts that with that shifting down one. It's empty AAA, it buggers off. The A site is exposed, and now it's calling for another anticodon, and that transfer RNA with the anticodon to that codon brings with it another amino acid, and on and on and on. Okay, let's go back here for a bit. I think this one kind of works, if I remember correctly. Oh, my gosh. They've done something on it. I'm not sure what it is. Let's try this one, then, shall we? Let's try this one. I haven't seen it yet, but it looks pretty good because their videos are pretty good. Their animations are pretty good. So RNA polymerase splits or unwinds and exposes, breaks those hydrogen bonds, thus exposing both sides of the DNA molecule, which, of course, exposes the codons that represent the specific protein that's needed as per the gene that's been exposed, right? And, of course, we have what's happening with RNA polymerase. It's creating an RNA molecule, or it's creating a messenger RNA molecule that hasn't existed before. It's not like this is a one-time deal where there's all these different messenger RNAs floating around inside the nucleus waiting to leave at any given time. No, no, no. Every time a protein needs to be created, it is the gene expression or the nucleus that turns on the switch to create the messenger RNA by splitting the DNA. And every time a new messenger RNA molecule gets created, every time that protein is needed. Because when the cell is done with that messenger RNA, we're not making that protein any longer, that messenger RNA gets all broken apart, and a lot of those compounds go back into the nucleus to be used for the next time we want to make a messenger RNA. So imagine the amount of genes that you have within strands of DNA as to the number of proteins you can make at any given time in your body. And every single one of us right now is building millions of proteins right now for whatever purposes the body requires at the time. Okay, so RNA polymerase unwinds the DNA and exposes one side of the DNA for transcription. There is a promoter which tells the RNA polymerase where to attach to begin said transcription. And of course, only one side is used, not both. And the RNA polymerase begins pairing the bases in a complementary pattern, with the only difference being where normally in DNA it's A to T, in RNA it's A to U. Okay? So it's creating a picture of the exposed gene that it's been reading. And you saw in the video where within the polymerase, it's putting together all the complementary bases as it reads through the DNA molecule, thus creating a full molecule called messenger RNA. Now, as you heard there, there's some cutting and splicing and things, but we don't care about that for this course. We just have to understand that there is this messenger RNA that gets created, okay? The transcription ends at the terminator, and then the polymerase leaves the transcribed RNA and DNA. The DNA zippers back up and goes back to normal again. But we have this now existent messenger RNA that's been created, which is the transcribed creation, the creation of the transcribed DNA gene. Yes? Okay. That is what leaves the nucleus to go say hello to ribosomes, okay? And remember, the ribosomes can either be free-floating or on the endoplasmic reticulum to make specific enzymes, proteins, remembering that traditionally free-floating tends to make proteins that are for the cell itself that they're in, and those that are on the endoplasmic reticulum are for export out of the cell to be used somewhere else. And the prime example I use is like goblet cells for making mucus in the sinuses. Those hemoglobins, of course, are being made in a cell, and off they go to areas where red blood cells are created to be used in new red blood cells and so forth. So that newly created RNA is called messenger RNA because it's going to send the message from the nucleus to the ribosome, which is translation. So this newly created mRNA, it specifies for the appropriate amino acids, both what type and in what sequence, to create whatever protein the gene asks for. Yes? Correct? Right? Because the gene is a specific protein. The ribosomes carry out the translation. And remember, there are two subunits to ribosomes. There is a small subunit and a large subunit. The small subunit is for reading the messenger RNA. And basically, the large subunit is for the binding, allowing a site for the new amino acids to come in and to bind all those amino acids together, right? The only thing I didn't like about that video, she keeps calling that chain of amino acids protein. It kind of is, but it isn't yet, because I've said many times, it doesn't need to be folded to become viable. But ultimately, it's making the protein. The large ribosome subunit contains three sites. It has the A site, where the transfer RNA is bringing in the next amino acid. It has the P site, and I always remember the P site is where the amino acids are peptide bonded. So therefore, I always thought of P as being the bonding site because it kind of represents peptide. And of course, the E site, pretty easy, E for exit. That's where the transfer RNA leaves because it's empty and it's no longer required. The other thing to remember is everything is stepping down one, thus exposing the A site for the new
transfer RNA to bring in the next amino acid in the link, and everything shifts down one, the next transfer RNA shifts down one, the next transfer RNA, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And every time that transfer RNA goes into the P site, you get a bond, you get a bond, you get a bond, you get a bond. As you saw in the video, those continuous bonds of amino acid starts exiting the large subunit as it's being created. Okay? So the mRNA binds to the smaller subunit at the mRNA binding site with the starting codon AUG. The tRNA anticodon UAC attaches to the mRNA by pairing the complementary bases, and we have our first amino acid methionine. It's the large ribosomal subunit that attaches to the smaller one, which now creates a fully functional ribosome. You cannot have a fully functional ribosome until you have the small and the large subunits connected together. You require both. Again, the smaller one to read the messenger RNA, and the large one, which is responsible for the binding of the appropriate amino acids that are being brought in by the transfer RNA. How many have I lost so far? What do you need? See, in this funky head, it all makes sense to me, but that's my responsibility to get you guys to think the same way that I do. Good Lord. Ultimately, let's think of it backwards. What are proteins made of? Amino acids. Okay? We need to bind amino acids together. And what, as I say, I always use the analogy of a cookbook. Whether it's a chocolate cake or a pork roast, right? You have to bring certain things together to make it function properly, right? You know, sometimes you have chocolate, sometimes you have applesauce, sometimes you have whatever. So you need to bring all those things together in the recipe to make the viable whatever it is you're making. It's no different with a protein. A protein requires X number of amino acids bound together in a particular pattern in order to create the viable protein that's being asked for. Again, that could be a multitude of proteins at any given time. So the reality is, the whole process of protein synthesis is first to make a copy of the gene, which of course is the recipe for whatever amino acid you want. And the second part is to take that copy and read it so that you can bind the appropriate amino acids together in the right sequence in order to make the appropriate protein that the gene was asking for in the first place. Does that make it easier? Okay. The steps are what gets a bit complicated, but they're still just the steps. The other thing that's key to remember is a codon is three base pairs, correct? Okay. So when we're creating the transfer RNA, every three tRNA represents an amino acid, the same as every three base pairs in DNA represented an amino acid. So therefore, if every tree represents an amino acid, the large subunit of the ribosome is in fact actually reading every single codon, every single tree. And every single tree is asking for a specific amino acid. The transfer RNA has the anticodon, or the match to the three pairs of the codon that the large unit is reading, and along with it, those three pairs, base pairs, that are the opposite to the tRNA base pair, just happens to bring along a specific amino acid with it. Does that clear it up for anybody? Pretty quiet here. No, not yet. What don't you get? What's the confusing part? Talk to me. It is a lot. It's a lot of steps. Remember down in the bottom, I've got three and three. Each of those represents an amino acid, and that's DNA. It's no different than RNA. RNA, three and three and three is an amino acid, amino acid, amino acid. Remember that the three is called a codon. The only reason the transfer RNA is called an anticodon is because it's the opposite of the codon that the large unit has read. Right? So UAC in the transfer RNA would be what? An anticodon of? Right. And AGC might just bring along phenylalanine, which is an amino acid. But don't quote me on that because I'm thinking ahead of myself. So if my letters are wrong, I completely apologize. Yeah, no, I said AUT. Okay, let's just do the simple. UUA. UUA would have an anticodon of what? UUA would be AAT. Right? So, therefore, that anticodon is on the bottom of a transfer RNA, and the transfer RNA on the very top, like a Christmas tree, just happens to carry the appropriate amino acid that's related to that anticodon. So you could have a strand of RNA, tRNA from the DNA that's UUA, 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 TT, or sorry, CG, CGC, 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 after one, after the other, after the other, after the other, right? So I don't know what the mathematics is, but with four bases and 20 amino acids, think of what are the mathematics for the variety of combinations you can get. It is ridiculous, right? But ultimately, that's all you're doing is reading the codon, transfer RNA brings the appropriate anticodon, and just so happens to bring the amino acid with it. That's the A spot. And the P spot is the peptide bond site where you bond one amino acid to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And the E site is where the empty tRNA buggers off, buggers off, buggers off. Okay? Yes. Always three at a time, correct. And every three equals a single type of amino acid. They represent an amino acid, yes. Always. There's only 20. No. Just understand that they all code for specific amino acids. Okay?
Why are the amino acids?
You can't, because every protein that you have is made up of bound amino acids.
So when you eat a steak, so you're eating a cow steak, that's cow muscle, and it's made entirely of protein. So when you eat a steak, you have enzymes both in your mouth and in your gut that take that solid piece of meat and over a period of time breaks down that protein of that cow muscle into amino acids. Gets rid of all the stuff that's left over that the body doesn't need, and you poop it out. And all those amino acids and the iron in there and that kind of stuff, that body utilizes all that. So when we say we have 20, there are 20 amino acids, 10 are in diet and 10 you make. So this is why you always have to be wary of your protein intake, because the body only makes 10 of the required 20. You must get the rest of your amino acids in your diet. Does it have to be meat? Absolutely not, right? There's many proteins that are found in vegetables that can replace. Now it's a bit difficult for vegetables than it is for meat. So we have what's called hemi and non-hemi. Hemi proteins are found in meat. We don't have to do a lot with those proteins. We break them down and we utilize them. But quite often with non-hemi amino acids, that in vegetables, quite often we need like a vitamin C that's required that helps the body absorb those non-hemi amino acids much better. This is why, unbeknownst to people in the past, if you had slices of orange or lemon with your salad, it's actually highly beneficial to pick up the proteins that you would find in vegetables. Give me some examples of vegetable proteins. Beans? Nuts? Legumes? Lentils? Tofu? Right? Quinoa? There's lots and lots and lots and lots. Lots of, this is why I get such a kick, because I think I told you for quite a while both my daughters were vegan in nature, and they go to the doctor and they'd say, you're not going to get enough proteins. Baloney. Indian Hindus have been eating no meat for how long? And they're not protein deficient, not ever, because they figured out how to eat properly, right? I used to say my daughter, when she first turned vegan, If you're going to be vegan, it's not French fries and salad. That's not going to work, right? Does that make more sense now? A little bit. A little less muddy. Starting to clear up a little bit. Okay. So you can see right here, you have your A site on the right, your P site in the middle, and your E site on the end. Of all three, the two E's you start to remember, E for exit empty tRNA, and P for peptide bond, middle. And then after that's the A site, which is the entrance site. And there's reasons for those letters, but we're not getting into that. What's that? Sure. So the anticodon of another RNA, it pairs with the second mRNA at the A site. The large subunit catalyzes the formation of the peptide bond between methionine, of course, which is the initiator amino acid, and then the next amino acid, whichever one that's been asked for, right? And then the resulting G-peptide protein becomes attached to the tRNA and the A site. Now, there are many proteins that have variability of peptide bonds, right? So there are dipeptides and tripeptides. So there are some proteins that are only two amino acids and some that are only three. But the vast majority of proteins are polypeptides, which means there's many, 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 many amino acids peptide bonded to make the viable protein. Okay? God, you even have protein in your tears. Oh, yeah, it's everywhere. Okay? You might try this. I like it, but that's because of the way my brain works. Some of you might not like it. So just remember also that the ribosome always shifts by one codon at a time. So three move in, three move down, three move out. Right? It's always three, three, and three. The process ends when the stop codon on the mRNA is reached. This causes the completed protein to release from the final tRNA. The last tRNA leaves the P site, and then the two subunits of the ribosomes break apart and go back to becoming a small subunit and a large subunit. So you can see it there. You can see that this one's a bit backwards. It's going the other direction. So, right, enter. So we've got A site, P site, E site. But you can see that the tRNA is bringing with it the specific amino acids, and it's at the P site that we get the peptide bond. And then once it leaves this tRNA, off it goes. And it can go get another one. It can go get another amino acid that represents those three anticodons, because there should be lots of amino acids floating around. Yeah. Oops. Yep. Correct. Correct. So translation can occur at approximately 15 peptide bonds per second. And the thing to remember, although we teach it in one tRNA and one ribosome, that tRNA can run through as many ribosomes as you want. So it's, you know, it's traveling from one into the next ribosome, into the next, and the next, because that tRNA can be used by many ribosomes at any given time. So you can see it here that this was, you know, this was running through from here, from 3 to 5, so this is AUG. So this AUG is already run through this one. You can see it's a few amino acids ahead, and this one just had AUG run through, so it's just beginning. So it's not unusual to have 100 ribosomes making the same protein at any given time, for example, because they're all reading the same tRNA, or mRNA, sorry. They're all reading the same mRNA. That was the one that we saw there. Okay. Yikes. Everybody needs a drink? Do you know I collect them? I have 40 bottles of them. Whiskey. Irish or Scotch? Which one? Either one. I have favorites for both. I do have a bottle of extra Añejo tequila at my house. $300 for the bottle. It's not to be drank. I use it for investment and swim down in the basement and sell them later. Okay. Now we're going to get more complicated. Dear God. All right. The mitochondria. Wait. Do you want me to do cytoplasm first to give you like a cleanser? So maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do that first. Let's do that first. Let's do cytoplasm first. Let's go back. Cytoplasm, it's back last week. You know, if you had mentioned, I probably would have forgot again. Everybody, I'll give you a second to find it. Oh, I don't know why he keeps doing this. Nope, we didn't. No, I know we didn't. Guys, I don't think you were. Filament, but I did talk about in lecture too a little bit. Okay, so cytoplasm is what? That cytocell. Cytoplasm is everything between the membrane and the nucleus. Okay, so all the cellular contents between the cell membrane and the nucleus, it's further divided into the cytosol and the organelles. Of course, we've done many of them already. We only have one left to do, actually. So the cytosol is the fluid portion that surrounds the organelles. It's anywhere between 75 to 90% made of water. It is, within it you find many suspended or dissolved substances that the cell can use at any given time, or is also being stored in the cell. Ultimately, it is the cytosol where we have many chemical reactions that occur within the cell's function. Now, within this, we have something called a cytoskeleton. And there are three types of protein filaments that we can find here. Think of them as being like, everybody know what rebar is? What do you need in a mud hut in order to maintain the strength of said mud? That's your straw, right? So you need something within it, the same as rebar in concrete, which is steel bars that are placed within concrete, which significantly strengthens the concrete to be able to deal with any stresses, those sorts of things. Protein filaments do play the same role. They're kind of the same thing. They do provide a fair amount of strength to the cell membrane and allow it to be more viable. So we can see here in these microscopic drawings, again, you don't tend to see this in drawings that artists do in most of the anatomy textbooks, but you can see that under a microscope, there's your nucleus, red is the cell membrane, and you can see how extensive these fibers can be at any given time within the inside of the cell. We can see them here as well. They hold organelles in place. They provide structural support to organelles within the cytoplasm itself. So they play a very big role. They have other roles as well. So the first are called microfilaments. They're the thinnest of all the filaments. They're mostly found at the edges, and they help generate movement and provide mechanical support. So the membrane's ability to be able to change shape and kind of, you know, the pseudopods that come out when we're doing endocytosis, that kind of stuff, that's all created through these microfilaments. They're made up of two protein strands, one called actin and the other called myosin. So they do play a somewhat minor role in the cell microfilaments, but they're extremely important and modified when we look at skeletal muscle tissue. It is actually the interaction between actin and myosin which does cause contraction in muscle. And without the interaction of these two microfilaments, you wouldn't have contraction at all. And it, as I said, it does provide support for these pseudopods or these extensions that can occur at any given time within a cell. And we can see here we've got our actin filaments here in green. The next are intermediate filaments, so we've gone from the thinnest to the next largest. They're a bit thicker than microfilaments. They are quite strong, so therefore they are placed in areas of great strength to be able to deal, or sorry, stress, to be able to deal with that stress. Also, these ones are responsible for holding organelles in the appropriate position within a cell so that things function. You know, you want that Golgi complex to be relatively close to the rough endoplasmic reticulum because of the, you know, the relationships. How does it get held there? It's the intermediate filaments that kind of make sure that you have a good relationship to each other within the cell itself. Okay, so there's your intermediate filaments there in blue. The largest are microtubules. I always call them like straws. Large, long, hollow tubes. They do help also to determine cell shape, but they also function in the movement of organelles. They function in the movement of chromosomes during cellular division. They also represent the cilia or flagella of other cells that happen to have those particular structures in them at a given time. So if we think of the cilia in the respiratory tract, they actually are made up of microtubules, the tail of the sperm cell, right? It's made of microtubules as well. So we can see here that, you know, they all have different shapes and configurations, but ultimately what to understand is that when we look at an inside of the cell microscopically, you know, where many, as I said, many artists tend to draw a relatively empty cell with organelles in it, just to give you a sense that they're in there. We've got a lot of other stuff going on in here with this exoendoskeleton, you'd almost call it, of these filaments, the cytoskeleton that exists inside. Okay, we can see here, this is, it was a video that's kind of broken down, but this is just the creation of putting together. And what are most of these filaments made of? Proteins. Okay? That was it. That's it. That was just like you cleanse the palate after you've had something and want to try something neat. So, calmed your brain down, give you something easy to think about. No, because I talked about it in class. I did use it in class. Okay. So, everybody's heard of the mighty mitochondria, correct? And as we said last week, mitochondria is responsible for creating ATP. So, it's known as the powerhouse of the cell. And we need the mitochondria because it represents about 90% of energy that any cell needs at any given time to do what it needs to do. Their shape can be different from cell to cell, but generally they tend to be oval. And depending on the function of the cell, there can be anywhere from 100 to several thousand. Obviously, if a cell is responsible to be doing something that requires vast amounts of energy, we're going to have lots and lots of mitochondria, right? It has a two-lipid bilayer membrane that is similar to the plasma membrane. Does anybody know about the suggested theory in the relationship between single-cell organisms and mitochondria? Sorry, the theory, yeah. That there's a theory out there, and in fact, the last cohort had a gentleman who's got his master's in human physiology and had a conversation, they're still saying it, that single-cell organisms and mitochondria were two separate organisms that lived in the primordial soup of Earth before we ever came along. And at some point, they decided that they would probably do better living together, so the mitochondria decided to live inside single-cell organisms, and the rest is history. Yeah, because mitochondria also has its own DNA. So it has its own membrane, it has its own DNA. So the thoughts were that the two got together and they were obviously better off being together, with mitochondria creating the ATP for cells to use and all the various functions that a cell does. So there are two membranes here. The outer one is smooth, while the inner one is thrown into a series of folds known as cristae. And these folds increase the surface area for the chemical reactions to take place. So when we look at it here, we can see that we've got a smooth outer shell. And within we have these foldings. Remember, when we see foldings, we're increasing surface area. So we're getting a greater surface area within the cell for actions to occur. And we can see that there's a number of things occurring here. And as we get through and we start talking a bit more about the Krebs cycle and cellular respiration and so forth, this inner membrane plays a very large role in this sort of thing, what's happening here. The fluid within these cristae is known as the mitochondrial matrix. Okay, so there's a fluid in there. Now, on the surface of these cristae, remember the cristae being the folds that we see here, on the surface are types of enzymes called oxidative phosphorylation enzymes. Okay? We're going to learn what role they play shortly. But ultimately, these oxidative phosphorylation enzymes help form ATP from food sources such as carbohydrates. Where does the energy in food come from? Sorry? Where does the energy in carbs come from? Sorry? Where does that energy come from? Where does that energy come from? Yeah, but where does that energy come from? I'm being an ass. The sun, right? So the sun, the plants grow with the sun through photosynthesis. The cow eats the plants, takes the sugars and the energy out of the plants, produces things, and so forth. So ultimately, when we talk about using food sources such as carbohydrates, everything that we eat, most things have some kind of energy in them that we utilize to build other things. Now, that can become from a lot of different ways, not necessarily directly, but quite a lot of it actually comes from the sun. Okay? Actually, Dave Suzuki did a huge show on that one a long, long time ago. So that was kind of like, wow, that was pretty mind-blowing. We have within the inner cavity of the mitochondria this matrix, and it contains another group of enzymes which control all the chemical reactions within the citric acid cycle, which is also known as the Krebs cycle. Right, okay. So the cycle also helps convert food sources into ATP. Now, the chemical reactions that occur in the mitochondria require oxygen to take place. So they tend to be close to where O2 comes in. So when we talk about cellular respiration, the reason we say the mitochondria is responsible for cellular respiration is because it utilizes oxygen to create ATP. How many people here have heard of anaerobic metabolism? Right, so anaerobic does produce ATP, but not near as much as aerobic metabolism, right? So aerobic metabolism, of course, uses O2, so therefore we call it cellular respiration because it uses O2. So we can say that, therefore, the mitochondria is known as the site of cellular respiration within the cell. So here we've got our outer smooth shell in this diagram. And here we have the inner convoluted cristae, just a small part of one. We can see here that within this inner membrane, we have chemical reactions within the Krebs cycle that feeds something else over here called the electron transport chain. And through the processes of the electron transport chain, we create a distinct difference of gradient between this side of this inner membrane and this side of the inner membrane. And remember, when we have a concentration gradient, we get a charge. Same as your car battery, right? You have a positive side and a negative side, correct? Your car battery has a positive side and a negative side. Without a positive side and a negative side, that battery is absolutely useless. It won't give you a charge. So you need a concentration gradient difference of ions. This is exactly the same thing. We create the energy by making a concentration gradient difference between one side of the cristae membrane and the other side of the cristae membrane. So the mitochondria, as I said, can self-replicate, meaning that when needed, they can produce new mitochondria by themselves without the direct help of the nucleus because they have their own built-in DNA, and that DNA from mitochondria came from mum. Everybody's heard about mitochondrial Eve? Yeah. So we all arose from one woman because when we look at the mitochondria, they think they know where she actually came from, where we all came from. They used to, they're not sure now, but they used to believe it was sub-Saharan Africa, right? And that's where it all began. There's a new theory that suggests it might be Australia, because they'd actually found older DNA in Australia as compared to Africa. And then when they were closer together, they may have started there and then worked their way its part. It's kind of cool, eh? What's that?
You're all Australian.
Yeah, we're all Australian, mate. Okay? So we can see here, remember, we've got the outer soft shell, and we have the inner convoluted. Right? And then the fluid within the cristae, the convolutions, is called the matrix, and that there are structures within that inner membrane that are responsible for the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain, which utilizes oxygen to create ATP. Therefore, it is known as aerobic metabolism. So, what is metabolism? It refers to all chemical reactions of the body. And remembering that we have anabolism or anabolic and catabolic reactions. So anabolic does what? It creates. And catabolic reactions break down. Okay? At any given time in your body, you're creating and breaking down all the time. Right? So when you eat your apple, you're catabolizing it to get it down into its finer sugars and fiber and so forth. And then your body utilizes those sugars from the apple to create other things, which is anabolic. So anabolic steroids, therefore, do what? Create muscle. Right. Okay. So catabolism produces more energy than is consumed. Correct? Does that make sense? So the breaking down of things creates more energy than is consumed. And anabolism, which is creation, consumes more energy than is produced. Kind of makes sense, right? Okay. This is why when you're lifting weights, what don't you want to do? You don't want to be in a catabolic state, or so they believe, right? Because they suggest that this is why true bodybuilder weightlifters quite often will not do much aerobic exercise, because they feel it makes them catabolic and it will prevent them from producing muscle mass. Until it's time for showtime, then they do a lot of aerobics. But yes, because you want to start breaking down adipose tissue to release the energy that's within that in order to feed the Krebs cycle to create ATP to perform whatever it is you're performing, as far as that goes. The unfortunate thing is, because we evolutionarily lived in a history of not having much, lots of droughts and so on and so forth, our body is excellent in storing fat and not so good at burning it. Yeah. Well, unless you want to go into, there's the whole new movement now into, ketosis and ketones and whatever. No, it's dangerous. So the molecule that's most often used in energy exchanges of living cells is ATP, also known as adenosine triphosphate. It couples energy release and catabolism and energy requiring anabolism. In other words, it does bring together both breaking down and creating at the same time within the context of the process of creating ATP. Often catabolism occurs in one part of a cell, such as the mitochondria, while synthetic reactions take place building things in the cytosol or at the endoplasmic reticulum. So a cell is constantly always creating and breaking things down at any given time in some sort of balance. So catabolism is the breaking down of molecules and polymers into simpler forms. Catabolism releases energy that is captured by phosphorylating ADP. ADP, of course, is adenosine diphosphate to produce ATP. So in other words, we have to have energy to create the bonding of what I call the second and the third phosphate molecule in ATP. We're going to learn that between the second and third, well, between the first and second as well, is what is called a high energy bond. So within the phosphate of ATP, the two phosphates are held together with a significantly high energy bond. And for us to get the energy to perform many things, such as integral protein pumps, all those sorts of things, we have to break the third phosphate from the second phosphate. That releases energy that gets absorbed by the body, and an amount of that energy released is used to drive pumps and things that require active processes. That's where it gets its energy from. Important areas of catabolism occur as part of the Krebs cycle, glycolysis, and the electron transport chain, which we will be discussing in detail. Anabolism are simple reactions that combine simple molecules and monomers to make more complex ones. And of course, this helps form the structural and functional components of the body. So again, when we eat the apple, right? It is a complex structure. It's, you know, fibers and skin and water and sugars and so forth. We then take that apple and through mastication and then digestion, we take those complex components of the apple and we break them down into further and further and further simpler compounds, and then we utilize those simple compounds to make more and more complex things that the body requires. So we're always breaking down and building up depending on what we're doing with it. But ultimately, you know, if one of you guys had an apple, the apple as it stands isn't worthy of much until we break it down and take from it what's required. So what does ATP do? A lot of chemical reactions are concerned with ATP. So chemical reactions in cells is concerned with converting the energy found in foods available to the various physiological systems of the cell, such as muscular activity, so just muscular contraction requires, secretion by some glands, maintenance of membrane potential, so we do have integral proteins that are constantly pumping electrolytes and so forth against concentration gradients at any given time. We have synthesis of substances in the cells themselves, and of course we have absorption from food from the GI tract, which of course takes a lot of energy for contractions and so forth to occur there. Yeah.
Like how?
How?
Yeah.
We are going to get into that in clinical anatomy. But it has to do with ATP provides the energy of the power stroke of the myosin on the actin. Ultimately, that's where it occurs. Okay? So, ATP plays a key role in making the energy of foods available for all these purposes. What's nice is ATP is labile, which means what? Maybe you're in chemistry? What is a labile compound? Not stable, easy to break down. And we want that with ATP, because if we had to work really hard to break ATP into ADP, it would become a bit costly for the body. So the fact that we can take ATP and break it down into ADP, thus releasing the energy required, is highly beneficial to us because it doesn't take a lot of work to take ADP and make it into ADP. Okay? ATP is a combination of adenine, ribose, and 3-phosphate molecules. The last 2-phosphate radicals are connected with the remainder of the molecule by high-energy bonds. So you'll hear me say this a lot, is that between the first and second and the second and third are high-energy bonds. And it is the release of those high-energy bonds, as I said, that gives us the energy for things to function at any given time in the body. Okay, so it's kind of the fuel, these high-energy bonds release. We're going to talk a bit about that. Well, I do talk about it here, sorry. So the last 2-phosphate radicals are connected with the remainder of the molecule by high-energy bonds. The amount of free energy in each of these bonds, so let's think about this. We're talking microscopic here, right? So we have got adenine and ribose sugars in this one little head, and then we have 3 little phosphate molecules. So think microscopically here, right? Think how small that is. You need to see this under a microscope. If I break the bond between the second and the third phosphate molecule, I release 12,000 calories. I missed a zero in that. It's 12,000 calories when you separate the second and the third phosphate molecule in an ATP molecule. 12,000.
In one.
It's crazy, eh? Well, but basically, I always use that as an example. What did we do when we created a hydrogen bond? All we do is split hydrogen. And what the hell happened there? One of some of the biggest bonds we ever saw. And all we're doing is breaking microscopic bonds. So we're doing the same thing, right? So we're utilizing a lot of energy within the second and third phosphate to utilize it. Now, what we're going to learn is we don't use all of it. A lot of it is... It's not inefficient, but it's not efficient either. Because what happens when we exercise? We get hot, right? And we sweat. Because we're kind of inefficient with those bond, that energy released. So a lot of that becomes heat in the body that we need to get rid of when we're exercising, when we're really pounding out energy to be able to form exercise, like muscle contractions and stuff.
Hydrogen isn't a labile thing,
no.
Though.
Like, no, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Yeah, so if ATP is so volatile, like, why is it not just exploding all that together? If it's
It can be a bit of attraction, but the reality is at any given time, for the amount of things that require ATP, quite often it's always blowing up, like a lot. Because I mean, even you're doing things within your cells right now that are much smaller reactions than just muscle contractions or soft muscle, smooth muscle contracting in the gut when you've had something to eat and so forth. So we are utilizing a lot, but yeah, a lot of it just gets released as heat. Therefore, removal of each of these radicals eliminates 12,000 calories of energy. After the loss of one phosphate radical, of course, it becomes ADP, and after the last release of the second radical, the compound becomes AMP or adenosine monophosphate. Ultimately, those are used in other more specific areas that we don't really talk about. All we're after is ADP to ATP back to ADP. That's what we're getting into.
Do they always break off in order, so it would be the first, second, and third phosphate, or whatever?
It's always the second and third.
Very. One will break off from the whole molecule.
In some chemical reaction.
Okay.
So and
between like the second.
What we're basically talking about here with the Krebs cycle and muscle contraction, that kind of stuff, we're basically going from ATP to ADP. But there are some other chemical reactions in other areas of the body where AMP can get used, get down to AMP. So therefore, ATP is present everywhere in the cytoplasm and nucleoplasm of all cells. And essentially, all the physiological mechanisms that require energy for operation obtain it from ATP. In turn, the food in the cells is gradually oxidized, and the energy released, or the energy that's created and released, is used to reform ATP. Thus, we always have a constant supply. So we're always within that Krebs cycle electron transport chain. We're creating the energy to always taking used ATP that's become ADP and making it back into ATP again at any given time. Okay? So polysaccharides and disaccharides are broken down into monosaccharides, glucose, sucrose, and galactose. So it doesn't matter what the sugars are, whether it's in like an apple or banana or something like that. We have to break sugars down. So we try to take, so polysaccharides would be what you call your complex carbohydrates, right? So many parts to it, so it's complex. Then those get broken down into disaccharides, which are two sugars, if you want to call that, and then into monosaccharides. And the monosaccharides that the body uses all the time, well, they are the monosaccharides, glucose, sucrose, and galactose. Those are the ones that are the monosaccharides. Those are the useful types of sugars the body uses for many things. Okay? Glucose represents the greater amount of these. And when we talk about the electron transport chain and the Krebs cycle and so forth, the sugar that gets used in the Krebs cycle is glucose. Okay? So we need glucose as the appropriate monosaccharide to run this system to create ATP. Monosaccharides are absorbed in the portal system, which is part of the liver. And after passing through the blood sinuses of the liver, they go everywhere else in the circulating system. So we have to think about it. The sugars do come from the gut, which is the food that we eat and break down and so forth, right? Before they can be used by the cell, of course, they have to be transported through the cell membrane into the cytoplasm. Now, these monosaccharides, like glucose, they can't travel through the membrane, correct? They're too large and they're water-soluble. So we need insulin in order to stimulate cells to take up said glucose into the cell. So remember that monosaccharides cannot diffuse through cell membranes. It's too large, and they enter the cytoplasm with a carrier protein via facilitated diffusion, such as insulin, for example, which is done with the ligand and the receptor. Once in the cytoplasm, it becomes disassociated from the carrier protein. So we've got glucose in there. Now, insulin increases the rate of glucose transport. Glucose can kind of wiggle its way very slowly into a cell, through a cell membrane, into a cell, but extremely inefficient. Now, one thing that does speed up the transport of glucose from outside the cell to inside the cell is actually exercise. So people who have insulin or have insulin-dependent diabetes, for example, they have to monitor their exercise because a good amount of exercise, they have to lower the amount of insulin they give themselves because exercise does increase insulin intake into cells
quite a bit. So this is why there's, you know, diabetics have, you know, many calculations as to what kind of exercise they did and having to calculate how much insulin to or not to take depending on how much exercise they did do. This is why with type 2 diabetics, we want them exercising as much as possible, okay?
The amount of glucose, this can increase insulin into the cell by as much as 10 or more times the rate as if there was no insulin. And the amount of glucose that can diffuse in the absence of insulin, except for the liver and brain, are far too little to supply the amount of glucose normally required for energy metabolism. Now, the one thing that's very interesting is the biggest organ that requires insulin or requires glucose is your brain. Your brain requires vast amounts of sugar in order to function properly. This is why you get not very nice on Sunday mornings if you haven't had anything to eat. And you wonder yourself, like, why am I so short-tempered this morning? And then you have a piece of toast with peanut butter or something, and you're not so short-tempered anymore. And that's because of low glucose. And if anybody here has ever witnessed with a grandparent, if they happen to be diabetic and the sugars get too low, grandma, who's never used the F word in her life, is screaming and yelling and cursing and swearing because of the lack of glucose, and it affects how brain function. And then they give them a little bit of sugar, and grandma becomes grandma again, just like that, because then the brain gets what it needs. Therefore, we can say that the rate of carbohydrate utilization of the body is controlled mainly by the secretions of the pancreas, of course, which is insulin and another hormone called glucagon. Okay? Now, the glucose has gone in the cell. Okay? What's to prevent the glucose from leaving the cell? It went in, can it come out? Kind of. Well, it actually does something which forces it so that it can leave. And this is known as phosphorylation. So when a glucose molecule enters a cell, it immediately binds with a phosphate radical. Therefore, because it's got a phosphate radical that's bound to it, this is known as phosphorylating the glucose. So this is phosphorylation. So a phosphate molecule attaches to the glucose, therefore it can't leave the cell. It's stuck in there because it's been phosphorylated. This phosphorylation is promoted by the enzyme glucokinase in the liver or hexokinase in pretty much all the other cells. So we get this bonding of a phosphate radical to the glucose molecule. What's interesting is it's irreversible in every cell in the body except the liver cells and the renal tubular epithelium and the intestinal epithelial cells. They contain an enzyme called glucose phosphatase, which can reverse the attachment and break the phosphate off the glucose for glucose usage somewhere else. But when a glucose molecule goes into a muscle cell, for example, it is phosphorylated. A muscle cell does not contain glucose phosphatase, and the glucose cannot leave the muscle cell. It's there until it's utilized. So we can say then that phosphorylation serves to capture the glucose molecule within the cell so that it cannot leave. The phosphate molecule activates the protein, making it unstable and more readily available for chemical reactions. Okay? Now, when we think about glucose going into the cell, we might get a little bit too much of it, yes? Right? So what do we do with it? Well, we can store it. So after glucose is absorbed in a cell, it can be used immediately for energy within the Krebs cycle electron transport chain complex. Or if it's not required, it can be stored where it's chemically changed again into something called glycogen, which is a very large polymer of the glucose molecule itself. Quite often, I liken glycogen, I call it muscle sugar. How many people here did track and did A's and B's and wind sprints? Anybody here do any kind of sports where they had to do horrible wind sprints like hockey or basketball or track for sprinting, that kind of stuff, or you'd almost vomit afterwards because you were working so hard? What we were doing in those kinds of training formats is we're trying to deplete the glycogen stores, which then causes the muscle cells to store more glycogen because it's now recognizing it needs more because it's being asked to do these exercises all the time. So the muscle starts to store more glycogen. That's the purpose of it. Okay? That's what wind sprints, that kind of stuff are. Some cells can store large amounts, especially which the liver can store vast amounts of glycogen, upwards to 5 to 8% of its weight, and muscle cells can store 1 to 3% of their weight. This formation of glycogen is called glycogenesis. So taking a glucose molecule, making a larger p- polymer and making it the store form of sugar called glycogen. Hey, take a break. Let's take it because we're leaving here a bit early. Take a break. We'll see you guys at 25:02. Okay, so we did talk about monosaccharides, and we talked about a couple of them, and I did mention that glucose is kind of the number one monosaccharide that the body uses to create ATP. So, as I say, glucose is the preferred source to create ATP in the human body. For glucose to be used by the body, of course, it has to pass the plasma membrane and then to the cytosol, and of course, that is fundamentally delivered by the release of the hormone insulin by the pancreas in order for that to happen. And so glucose entry is always turned on in neurons and hepatocytes. So, of course, neurons require lots of glucose, so they easily have mechanisms by which glucose can enter into the cell and feed it, as well as those cells that are found in the liver, which are hepatocytes, and glucose can easily enter liver cells in order to functionally meet the metabolic requirements of those cells. And as we know, once glucose enters the cell, it is phosphorylated, of course, which prevents it from leaving the cell that it has then entered into. Now, oxidation of glucose is known as cellular respiration. So glucose is the initial energy source to help create ATP. It feeds the fire, shall we say. There are four steps that breaks down glucose to create ATP. The first is called glycolysis. Then we have the formation of something called acetyl coenzyme A. And then from there, it goes into the Krebs cycle. And then the products of the Krebs cycle enter into another process called the electron transport chain. Okay? We're going to talk about all of them. So let's do glycolysis, and then we'll call it a night. So glycolysis is the most important means of energy release from the glucose molecule. This is followed by the oxidation of the end products of glycolysis. And that'll make sense in a bit. Glycolysis means I split a single glucose molecule to create two molecules of something called pyruvic acid, or also because it's an acid, it can be called pyruvate. Okay? So the body takes a single molecule of glucose and through chemical reactions creates two pyruvic acids. It takes 10 successive steps of chemical reaction to take that glucose and create two pyruvate. We don't have to know them. Just understand that it takes a lot to take a glucose molecule and make it into 2-pyruvate. All right? Each step is catalyzed by at least one specific protein enzyme. So that means that those 10 steps require 10 different enzymes to take that glucose molecule to make it into a pyruvate. And what is an enzyme? A protein. Okay? Glycolysis utilizes 2 molecules of ATP to produce 4 molecules of ATP. So therefore, glycolysis has a net gain of producing 2 ATP molecules. So to take those 10 steps to take a glucose molecule and knock it into 2 pyruvates, it takes 2 ATP to do that. And that process also creates 4 ATP. So therefore, we only have a net gain of 2 because it took 2 to make 4. We'll get a net gain of 2. Okay? Okay. The first 3 reactions involve the addition of a phosphate group. Phosphorylation to, that was weird, to glucose, its conversion to fructose, and the addition of another phosphate group to fructose. Process involves energy, of which, of course, 2 ATP molecules are converted to ATP, thus releasing energy and forming pyruvate. Are they still there? Would it be an idiot or something? Okay. So we have glucose that's phosphorylated, and then we add another phosphate group to glucose, its conversion to fructose, and the addition of another phosphate to the fructose. So therefore, we can say the doubly phosphorylated molecule of fructose splits into 2-3 carbon compounds that undergoes further reactions to become pyruvic acid. So there's a couple reasons why I put this in here. First is phosphorylation phosphate. And the second is you've got something here now called carbon. Carbon is kind of a byproduct of many of these processes that is required to produce other substances eventually. Okay? You also, through glycolysis, produce two energy-containing NADH compounds. Not going to get into it. Just know it is NADH. Okay? Through the last four steps, four more ATP are produced as our two molecules of pyruvic acid. So fundamentally, at the end of glycolysis, it used two ATP to create four ATP and two pyruvate. So glycolysis creates four ATP and two pyruvate. And it took two ATP to do that, so we get a net gain of two. Okay? Remember, two ATP were required for the resulting to a net gain of ATP. Now, because we didn't see anything about oxygen there, this is anaerobic metabolism. So the two pyruvate, the creation of the two pyruvate and the four ATP is all done without the presence of oxygen. Therefore, it didn't take place in the mitochondria because the mitochondria requires oxygen. So anaerobic metabolism does not take place in the mitochondria, but very close to the mitochondria. Okay? Therefore, this is known as anaerobic or without oxygen respiration. Okay? Now, this pyruvic acid depends on oxygen. Well, this is still part of it. This is still part of glycolysis. Yeah. Okay. So, pyruvate that gets created, so we've got two molecules of pyruvate, it can go one of two ways. Right? So, if there's no oxygen present when the pyruvate is created, the pyruvic acid is reduced by the addition of two hydrogen atoms, and the pyruvate becomes lactic acid. So this is why when you talk about anaerobic metabolism, you build vast amounts of lactic acid. So sprinting, hence the reason why the legs burn so bad, weightlifting, why the muscles burn so bad, because if there's no oxygen present, the pyruvate becomes lactic acid. Now, you've probably heard that lactic acid buildup is what causes muscle soreness after exercise, correct? Not true. Lactic acid goes immediately to the liver where it's reconverted. And you've also may have heard that massage promotes lactic acid movement out of the muscles. Another mistake, doesn't happen. Right? The body takes care of lactic acid. That being said, if you think of weight training, when you're in that anaerobic state weight training, you get to a point where that last couple of repetitions, you can barely do it. The muscles are burning. They're not functioning properly. Why? Because you've made so much lactic acid, the environment around the muscle cells is so acidic, they can't function properly. So that's why you're barely getting through those last couple, because you've built such an acidic environment in around those muscle cells, they just can't function properly. Okay? Even in heart, when you're having a heart attack, you build an acidic environment with chemicals that are the result of enzymes that break down the myocardial cells. You've probably seen this on TV, you know, where someone's having a heart attack and they're like, sodium bicarbonate, right? And they actually inject sodium bicarbonate into the patient. That's true, because it takes and it lowers the acidic environment around the heart, and the heart has a better chance of beating. The only difference between the movies and TV and real life, we don't shove the needle right in the middle of their chest into the heart like you see in the movies. We actually put it in an IV so it goes through the bloodstream to the heart. You know, I think of, the Quentin Tarantino one, Pulp Fiction, where she's dying and he drives the needle into her chest. Right? No, it doesn't work that way. So we've got, we had these two NADH. When we have this anaerobic state, we have NADH that's also produced and allows glycolysis to continue. The lactic acid goes out of the cell quickly, enters the blood, goes to the liver, and it's converted back to pyruvic acid, which is really cool. So very quickly, lactic acid leaves the muscle, goes right to the liver, gets reverted back to pyruvic acid. But when oxygen is present, pyruvate does not become lactic acid. It becomes coenzyme A. It becomes a different compound in the presence of oxygen called coenzyme A. And when there's oxygen and we create coenzyme A, that coenzyme A goes right into the Krebs cycle, and then we enter into aerobic metabolism. So with no oxygen, we've got our two ATP. We got pyruvate, but because of no oxygen, we get lactic acid, which then becomes a byproduct of anaerobic metabolism, and off it goes to the liver to get converted. In the presence of oxygen, we can utilize that pyruvate and we convert it into coenzyme A, which then can enter and drive the Krebs cycle anaerobic metabolism, which then produces vast amounts of ATP. Yes? Okay, so remember that without oxygen, the pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid, where it goes to the liver to be converted to pyruvic acid. This happens very rapidly, and in the presence of oxygen, the pyruvic acid is converted to acetyl-CoA. See you next week. Okay.